When you apply for a new job, you expect the written application, the personal interview, and the dreaded time spent waiting for a call back. But more and more applicants now find themselves asked to respond to statements like, "This country needs higher moral standards," or, "I like tall women." More and more companies use personality tests to try to learn about an applicant's weaknesses and strengths, what kind of job he or she might be best suited for. This $400 million industry is hardly confined to the job market. Tests like the Myers-Briggs, the Rorschach, and the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory are used in everything from child custody cases to online dating services. Even though more than 17.5 million people take these tests every year, questions remain over accuracy, effectiveness, over what they tell us about human nature. In her new book, The Cult of Personality, How Personality Tests Are Leading Us to Miseducate Our Children, Mismanage Our Companies, and Misunderstand Ourselves, Annie Murphy-Paul says the wide use of these tests has deeply troubling consequences. Later in this program, we'll talk about antidepressants and kids. How should parents and doctors respond to this week's warning from the FDA? But first, personality tests. If you've taken one of these tests to get a job, a promotion, or a date, maybe. What did the results say about you? Was the test helpful? Were you surprised? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from our bureau in New York is Annie Murphy-Paul, and it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
At the basic level, what's the goal of a personality test?
The goal of a personality test is unlike an intelligence test or an aptitude test. It's not to see what we know or what we can do. It's really to find out who we are, what we're like. So it's going for something very big, something very amorphous, and I think that's why they so often fail.
Mm-hmm. Now, the bulk of them, as described in your book, were devised as ways to diagnose mental illness.
That's right. That's how the Rorschach was invented, the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. They started in mental institutions, and they're looking for pathology. They're looking for sickness, and that's what they find. And the problem is that these tests are now being used among a large number of normal people for whom these tests were never intended.
And used in some ways, even their originators are saying, is not appropriate.
Yes, these tests were invented so long ago that many of the originators are dead. But they, towards the end of their lives, I'm thinking in particular of Stark Hathaway, the creator of the MMPI, he came to believe maybe we couldn't capture personality in a test, even though that's what he had spent his entire life trying to do.
Now, if you're taking a test, presumably if you take it one day, you should get pretty much the result if you take it another day. Is that true in terms of personality tests, or does it vary test to test?
What you've just described is what scientists refer to as reliability. If you take a test one day, you should get the same result the next day. And yet, many personality tests do not meet that basic criterion. The Myers-Briggs, for example, which is one of the most popular personality tests available, research has shown that as much as 75% of people who take the Myers-Briggs one day get a different four-letter personality type when they take it again. So you're more likely to get a different personality type than to get the same one. And this is a personality type that the Myers-Briggs proponents say is an inborn and unchanging.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the other two tests, the big ones, the Minnesota Multiphase and the Rorschach. Myers-Briggs, what was that originally devised for?
The Myers-Briggs, there's a very interesting story about the creation of the Myers-Briggs. It was created by a Pennsylvania housewife named Isabel Briggs Myers, who didn't have any training in psychology, didn't have any affiliation with the university, and didn't have a research lab. She was simply interested in people, curious about people, and decided to create a personality test using the ideas of Carl Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And she tried it out on her friends and neighbors. She came up with the items on her own. And today it's a personality test taken by 2.5 million people every year.
Well, with respect, you know, I'm sure it has some interesting aspects, and not meaning to demean housewives in any way, but How did she come up with a test that has been used by so many people for such a long time?
Well, I think she did have a kind of genius for creating a test that would make people feel good when they got the results, even as it was useful for institutions to label and even manipulate workers and students and people in organizations. So it was just such a useful test because it allowed people to label themselves in a way that they found inoffensive. That it took off, and it's now a major part of many corporations' human resource practices.
So if you administer these tests or if you've taken them, would be interested in your phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking with Annie Murphy-Paul, who's the author of a new book, The Cult of Personality. And let's get some listeners involved. Chris joins us on the line from Minneapolis.
Yes, I had a question about some tests that the author or the your guest may or may not know about. Years ago, I was a counselor for kids in a treatment facility, and I actually am in Minnesota, so the MMPI is something I was familiar with. And so at the time, which was 20 years ago, I learned about it. But then recently, maybe in the last 5 years, I've taken different tests in the form of an employment process. Mm-hmm. And the thing that bugged me about some of them, and they were different, and I didn't even recognize some of them, was that I wasn't offered to see the results. In fact, when I asked one time, they said it was something that was private. And, of course, not knowing what the results were after spending an hour, sometimes two, taking a test, seemed a little strange to me. So I guess I'm wondering about what their effectiveness is in employment situations and whether an applicant has the right to find out the results and what type of test it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, for many years, the conventional wisdom within psychology was that test takers should not get the results of their tests because they couldn't deal with the truth about themselves. This, you know, it's kind of a paternalistic attitude on the part of the psychologists. But in terms of the workplace situation, no, there's unfortunately job applicants don't have any right to ask to see the results of their tests. They don't have any right to turn down a test. I mean, they can walk out, they can refuse to take it, but then they just won't get that job. So it's becoming more and more just kind of a hurdle that job applicants have to jump over.
Chris, did you get the job?
Actually, no, and it turns out that it was just as well. But the other thing was wondering just about the type of test it is. I mean, you mentioned there's several types. Is there a type of test that employers like best and, in fact, may or may not, result in something that's useful for them as employers?
Well, I wonder if the test that you were taking was something that's known as an integrity test or an honesty test, which is intended to tell whether a potential employee will be honest, will be trustworthy, will, you know, trying to tell in advance whether someone will lie or cheat or steal on the job.
Pilfer anything from paper clips to the pension fund.
Exactly, exactly. And integrity tests have a rather poor record for predicting who will do those things. There was a review conducted by the federal government's Office of Technology Assessment that found that 95.6% of people who failed honesty tests were incorrectly classified as dishonest. So I wonder if that was the kind of test you were taking.
It might have been. Because again, I didn't recognize it as being the Briggs-Myers looking test or the MMPI, which was I was familiar with. But thank you very much. Interesting program.
Okay,
you're
Chris.
Welcome.
Thanks for the phone call.
Bye-bye.
Let's talk now with Yen. Yen's calling from Columbus, Ohio.
Yes. Before I get to my what I was calling about the integrity test.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them don't have the possibility of saying no. There is, I steal once a week, or I steal all the time.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And that is a big problem with those. I've taken a lot of these tests recently, since I'm a recent college graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up a few summers ago taking, finding out that after a great interview to get a job, that they were going to hire, they were like, oh, we'll hire you, we'll give you a call on Monday. And then my friend, who was a manager who got me the interview, was told that they couldn't hire me because of the personality test.
Mm.
I then ended up going and talking to a social worker at Ohio State, referred me to a psychiatrist at Ohio State, and they had me take the Minnesota test.
Mm-hmm. The multiphase, yeah.
Completely the opposite of my actual personality. Because it says, be brutally honest, have you ever thought, and it's pretty much, at least the first half of the test was, have you ever been depressed?
Mm-hmm.
How depressed are you? How depressed have you ever been? And have you, over and over again. So it doesn't seem like any of these tests are actually that great of an idea.
Well, Annie Murphy, Paul, if they're if they're that inaccurate, if they're that useless, why do people pay $400 million a year for them?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I mean, I think the people who do the hiring need an at least quasi-scientific rationale for choosing among the many applicants that they get for an advertised job. And a personality test looks like an easy, simple, efficient way to sort out who's going to be a better employee from who wouldn't be a very good employee. So it's useful in that way. Whether or not they're actually getting accurate results from the personality test is another matter.
Is it useful? And by the way, again, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it. But is it useful in determining who might be a good, I don't know, engineer and who might be a good social worker? I mean, different lines of work?
Mm-hmm. The personality tests are used for that quite often. The Myers-Briggs is one. Because that you'll see that they publish lists of personality types and the kind of people who have that personality type and which professions they go into. But predicting human behavior is an extremely difficult art, and it's something that psychologists are no better at than, you know, stock investors or anybody else who would like to know what people will do in the future. And personality tests, I think, have very limited value in predicting how a human being is going to act.
Let's talk with Jeff. Jeff's calling from West Bloomfield, Michigan.
Yes, good afternoon. Back in the 90s, myself, my wife, my ex-wife now, and my children were all evaluated. I believe it to be very, very accurate. It pinned me on the tail on the donkey and also on my ex-wife. The problem was, the evaluator, who was a psychiatrist, was not clinical, but I guess educational in her PhD, and also had, I believe, a counter-inference with me, and I ended up being the bad guy. I later had to hire a very good, expensive psychiatrist who then evaluated it, and then it kind of brought everything to a wash. In the end, though, I did end up with my children after my wife had decided to try to commit suicide for the fourth time, which could not be brought out in court. I had already been through divorce. And her evaluation several years later was exactly what the evaluation of the test was, is that she was a borderline personality. It showed that she was elevated in everything. And the point is the evaluator is very important. And being an intelligent individual, I would rely on these things to evaluate anybody at any time because, like I said, they pinned me right on top of the head.
Okay, Jeff, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
Annie Murphy, Paul, we just have a few seconds left in this segment, but child custody, these are big stakes.
Yes, they are. And I think a lot of people think of personality tests as frivolous, harmless fun, but the fact is that personality tests are used to make very important decisions about people's lives.
We're talking about personality tests, how they're administered, and what they aim to find, and we're taking your calls. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. For a look at some personality tests online, you can head to npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We're back after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about personality tests, their effectiveness, their accuracy, and their value. Our guest is Annie Murphy Paul, the author of the new book, The Cult of Personality, How Personality Tests Are Misleading Us to Miseducate Our Children, Mismanage Our Companies, and Misunderstand Ourselves. We, of course, want to hear from you. If you've ever taken or administered personality tests, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from Atlanta, Atlanta, Georgia, is William Harris. He's executive director of the Association of Test Publishers, a trade group for providers of assessment tools, including personality tests. And it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
I know you've been listening from the beginning of the program, and the criticism that you've been hearing about the accuracy and the value of these tests, how do you respond?
We build tests that are, first of all, guided by the standards that are called the Standards for Educational and Psychological Tests. These are the same standards that the intelligence testing publishers use, the achievement testing publishers. These are standards that are basically consistent across all major publishing houses.
Excuse me, Mr. Harris, the phone line is just dreadful to you. We're going to hang up and call you right back and get you back on
okay. And
ask you that question again. I apologize to the listeners for that. We'll take another call with Annie Murphy, Paul, and then get back to William Harris as soon as we get an audible line up to him. Here's a call from Henry. Henry's calling from Edina, Minnesota.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Henry.
Thank you. I'm Henry Niles, and I've got a website called assessment.com. We have a product called MAP, which stands for Motivational Appraisal of Personal Potential. We have about between 8,000 and 9,000 people take it every day. But this is a self-help assessment. It's not trying to tell the person what their motivational profile is so they can move their life closer to that.
And would you rely on its accuracy?
Oh, definitely. It's got very high reliability and validity.
And what kind of test is it?
It's a preference record test where we ask you, would you like to build a railroad or would you like to work in the park? And we're develop a motivational assessment, and then you can use that assessment to explore 1,000 different careers.
And you say it's reliable. How do you measure that?
Well, reliability is that a test retest as any said before, and we have people take the test once and then in an interval of 6 months or then in another year.
Mm-hmm. And you say, you sort of said it's a self-help guide. Would you want such a test to be relied upon to decide important matters like child custody?
Oh, no, I would never want that.
Annie Murphy, Paul, Henry's mm-hmm. hardly the only person to come up with these online tests, and a lot of them are fun.
They are fun. They are fun. And I would never say that any lasting damage will come from having taken a which Lord of the Rings character personality test online. Which Lord of the Rings personality type are you test online. But the fact is that they are used to make very important decisions. And one thing that I found very interesting about what Henry was saying is that it's not just that these personality tests are imposed by employers or educators or psychiatrists and psychologists. People do volunteer to take them. This, you know, Henry's resource is a self-help resource. These are people who want to do this. And that, to me, is the more interesting question. Why would people volunteer to put themselves in a box, to sort of slap a label on themselves? And I think that one reason is that we just face so many choices in our lives today, and there's so many options, so many directions we could go, that it's actually very comforting to restrict ourselves, to have someone else sort of narrow the options for us, whether or not that is really based on anything scientific. It's just easier and simpler to say, I'm an INTJ, and therefore I should become a professor. You know, it makes everything a lot simpler.
So, Henry, how do your customers who take these tests, how do they evaluate them?
Well, in our particular assessment, there is no right or wrong or box. There's actually 5 million different results that are possible, and everybody's different. And it's only telling you what, feeding back to you in a language that you can understand. It articulates your motivational profile so that you can understand how to work your life closer to the things you like to do versus the things you don't like to do.
Okay, well, thanks for the phone call, Henry.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. We're going to try again now with William Harris of the Association of Test Publishers. Can you hear me, Mr. Harris?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
You're much better, much better. We appreciate it. And again, well, we wanted to get your response to the criticism that we've been hearing about these kinds of personality tests over the past 25 minutes or so.
Yeah, the criticisms, I think, are unfounded from the standpoint that it's not consistent with the research that has been going on for over the last five decades. Much of the tests that have been developed, many of the tests that have been developed, are based on the guidance document called the Standards for Educational and Psychological Testing. That document was probably around when Isabel was developing her product, the Myers-Briggs, back in the 50s. It certainly was around whenever others were developing their tests. So I think most of the products that are out there today, most of the personality measures, are well constructed, are based on strong science, and have thorough documentation.
What about the reliability factor, the ability to go in and take the test on October 15th and get one result and go back and take it again on March 15th and get pretty much the same result?
Well, there's two types of tests. Some tests measure state, one state, which basically will change over time from one day to the next. And the other set of personality measures will measure a much deeper rooted type of trait. Most of the tests that are measuring trait, once again, are built so that their reliability and their validity and their utility is quite strong, so that they will stay firm across time.
Mm-hmm.
Except the fact that you do have error in any type of measurement device, but for the most part, the uniqueness of that assessment should be evident from the first testing to the second testing to the third testing.
Are some tests better than others?
Oh, absolutely, Mike. Oh, absolutely correct in terms of saying that, because quality is always an issue. Some conceptual frameworks are better than other conceptual frameworks when it comes down to measuring specific attributes or traits. If, for instance, I'm trying to measure five factors of a person in terms of the big five factors, I may use a big five personality measure versus something that measures psychopathology.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depends on what you're trying to measure. But there's no single test that's going to be able to provide you with a comprehensive assessment of an individual. All of our test publishers recommend using test batteries. Each one of these tests in a battery will provide some unique information and certainly some common information. And because you're getting unique and common information, you have a much better chance of making a better decision.
Well, I can understand why the Association of Test Publishers would want everybody to use batteries of different tests and maybe take a couple of weeks and give people a lot of tests, but most employers are only going to use one.
Well, even most employers are going to use multiple steps to make a hiring decision. Whether they use, for instance, I believe Ms. Paul indicated that there's integrity tests.
Mm-hmm.
An integrity test may be used, an interview, a background check, a drug test. Those are all parts of that overall assessment process. The integrity test has to be job relevant, however.
You mentioned pathology, social pathology earlier. A lot of these personality tests were designed to gauge a person's mental health. How well does that transfer to the employment process?
Well, first off, all states as well as the federal government has very stringent privacy laws. So the test has to be job relevant, first and foremost. If it's measuring psychopathology or emotional stability, oftentimes or almost always it has to be given or administered after there has been a conditional offer of employment. So, for instance, if I'm going to select a police officer, I may give the individual a number of tests. But once I make a conditional offer, I may then at that point in time measure their emotional stability. But I cannot do that prior to making a conditional offer.
All right. Well, let's get another listener on the line here. Fred is with us from Lockport, in New York.
Oh, good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
And beautiful downtown Lockport on the Erie Canal, to be precise. I'm calling about what was just mentioned, integrity tests.
Mm-hmm.
And mentioned previously, I've taken a number of them. In fact, it's actually the same test for all different companies, different times, and different temporary employment agencies. And, it's a range of answers. Completely agree with the statement to completely disagree, and in between.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, these statements, I mean, many of them, you know, I feel it's okay to hit people in order to get respect, or I feel it's okay to bring a gun to work. Or, you know, I feel it's okay to bring a knife to work, or I feel it's okay to take uppers to get through an afternoon, on and on, et cetera, et cetera.
Are you saying, Fred, it's pretty easy to figure out what answers they want?
Yes. I mean, that if you were to feel this way, like taking uppers or beating on people, not that, and I don't. But if I were to feel this way, I would figure to answer the other way around.
Let's get a response from William Harris.
Well, all of these integrity measures are oftentimes, when they're put into a employment setting, are going to be piloted for a number of months or even a year. And the reason why they're being piloted for some period of time is to determine whether there's going to be a reduction in inventory shrinkage. If there's a reduction in inventory shrinkage, almost always you're going to see the implementation of that assessment. Looking at individual items is like looking at a dot on a Monet picture, for instance. It doesn't tell you the picture or give you the full story. You have to look at all the items, understand that together it provides you with an accurate information. The danger of looking at individual items is that you miss the forest.
Okay. Fred, thanks for the phone call. We appreciate it. And William Harris, thank you for your time today, and we also wanted to thank you for your patience with our technical problems earlier.
Oh, you're most welcome.
Nice of you.
Goodbye.
William Harris is Executive Director of the Association of Test Publishers. He joined us from his office in Atlanta, Georgia. Annie Murphy-Paul, if you have taken one of these tests or one kind of test and you're given it again, aren't you getting better at taking the test, as our caller suggested?
I actually avoided taking the personality test that I write about in the book because I didn't want my results on the tests and whether I felt that they were accurate or not to bias my evaluation of the scientific evidence. So I actually have not taken any of these tests, and I think I probably do know far too much now to ever take them.
But even the question that we heard at the beginning of the program, do you like tall women? What is that supposed to find out?
Yes, that's a question from the MMPI, the MMPI was designed in a very interesting way. As the inventor, Stark Hathaway, said, we allowed the mental patients to design their own test. And what he meant by that is he took a large number of questions, over 1,000 questions, and he put them to groups of mental patients in his institution and a group of normal people that he came to call the Minnesota Normals. This was a group of 700-something Minnesota citizens that he sort of corralled into his experiment because they were visiting their relatives at the hospital where Stark Hathaway was working.
Mm-hmm.
They were all of Scandinavian descent, all Protestants, mostly farmers and blue-collar workers. And this group of Minnesota Normals created the standard of psychology standard of normality for the next 50 years until the test was revised. But anyway, the way Stark Hathaway went about creating this test was he posed all these questions to both of these groups, and depending on their answer and not paying any attention to the content of the question or whether it really made any sense, if you just, in a face valid way, just looking at the question and the answer, just the way that you answered would put you in one category or another. So if most schizophrenics answered the question, I like tall women, one way, and most normals answered it in a different way, then those were the results that Stark Hathaway used to create his key, his scoring key.
Yeah, we're talking about personality tests with Annie Murphy-Paul. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And before we get too far away, I wanted to ask you to respond to some of William Harris's statements about scientific rigor and professional administration. Do those standards apply, do you think?
Well, when we're talking about workplace personality tests, we simply don't know, because these are the products of profit-making companies. Many of these workplace personality test producers claim that their tests and information about the way the tests were developed and how well they work is proprietary information. They don't want to share that with their competitors. And so nobody really knows how well they work. Certainly the companies make all kinds of overblown claims, but they don't share that information with the public, and they don't have to. So I would be suspicious, to say the least, or skeptical, to say the least, of these claims of scientific reliability and validity.
All right, let's get another caller on the line. Miranda. Miranda's on the line from Lafayette, California.
Yes, I am. I'm a first-time caller, and this is very timely. My daughter is a senior in high school, and as part of the college counseling process, they've introduced this wonderful new program called Naviance, and part of it is a self-discovery assessment, which is a, it seems, I'm not really familiar with this, but just this incredibly simplistic, almost idiotic personality assessment. And her father and I are very, you know, reluctant to even have her complete it, because I think, for one thing, it's an easy fix to give the new college counselor, you know, an immediate profile without taking the time and sitting down with the student. It's also, they claim, predictive. It spits out lists of colleges, and it offers possible career paths, which so far from our mind right now, and I'm questioning the value of this and whether it is just a time-saving thing for the guidance counselor, and what your expert has to say about it.
Annie Murphy-Paul?
I think you're absolutely, your caller is absolutely right to be concerned about that. I mean, I think in our increasingly bureaucratized institutions that we're all a part of, schools and corporations, people are looking for shortcuts. People are looking for a way to reduce their workload, and personality tests have become one of our favorite time-saving measures. And I think you're absolutely right to want the guidance counselor to actually spend time with your daughter as a person and not see her as a list of, you know, filled-in bubbles, and make incredibly important recommendations about her future based on her answers to a pen and paper test.
Well, that's the issue we're facing now. Actually, we're way, you know, far ahead of the curve with this, because my daughter's already decided where to apply. And it's trying to navigate whether we just do it or even do, you know, random check boxes randomly, so we go with the flow and not get the possible
backlash. If she's decided to go to MIT or UCLA, I'm not just picking two different schools, take the test and see what they spit out, and it might be interesting.
Well, I said for entertainment value, it might be worth it, yes.
Okay.
Miranda, thank you very much.
Thank you for the phone call.
You're welcome. Bye.
Annie, I'm afraid we're running out of time today, wanted to thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you for having me.
Annie Murphy-Paul is the author of The Cult of Personality, How Personality Tests Are Leading Us to Miseducate Our Children, Mismanage Our Companies, and Misunderstand Ourselves. She joined us from our bureau in New York. When we come back from a short break, a medical expert takes your questions about how antidepressants affect young people. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also email TOTN at npr.org. This is NPR News.